Welcome to Fire Engineering Scenes of Violence on Blog Talk Radio. Wow, pretty crazy day today if you paid attention to the news at all. So we had a guy roll into D.C. in a pickup truck claiming that he had a vehicle-borne IED and parked in front of the Library of Congress. Shortly thereafter that, we had a suspicious package in Times Square in New York City. Lots of tensions and concerns, you know, surrounding the Afghan withdrawal, the general social discord leading up to that for a variety of different social things. We're pretty ripe right now as a society for a lot of pent up aggression, some social and political agendas that, with COVID and everything else going on, the individual just needs a, as the Joker said in Batman, Heath Ledger, you know, all you need is a little push. Well, there's a lot of pushing going on. I got some great concerns as to what the future is going to hold. But that being said, this evening we have David Mellon from the Kansas City metro area on with us to have a chat. Dave, are you on?
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, no. Thank you. Love to have you. You know, if you pay attention to the show, I'm not real good at running down people's bios. So why don't you tell people a little bit about who you are, what you're about, so that they grasp who we're talking to.
Yeah, absolutely. So, my name is Dave Mellon. I live in the Kansas City metro area. I volunteer in Leavenworth County, just west of the metro. I also work full-time for a suburb in Wyandotte County, where Kansas City, Kansas is. I've been a TAC medic for about 4 years. I've been a paramedic for coming up on 18, and I've been in the fire service since 1998. So I presented at FDIC, and I own a fire training company called Valor Fire Training, and got to know Steve quite a while ago, and he called tonight and asked me if I'd want to be on the show.
That's completely and totally accurate. So, TAC medic, you know, out of all that, you hear TAC medic and you're like, ooh, TAC medic. How long have you been doing that?
So I got into it about 4 years ago, and just, became a little bit more active. We had always, our agencies had always kind of taken the backseat approach. So we weren't integrated with teams. We were just there on standby. And it was really just to have dedicated paramedics to assist once the teams had done their job. And so we were always staged, you know, away. Within the last year with an agency that I work part-time for, they've started the process of integration with the teams. And so we've done a lot more tactical training and a lot more equipping so that we're better able to handle those type of situations. Right now we're still unarmed. But we do, you know, in the foreseeable future, we will have the capability of at least having a sidearm for protection purposes. But, you know, the Kansas City metro area has a lot of really great programs of a lot of really great organizations. Some of them are integrated, some of them are not. And so just depending on the needs of the mission, they'll call who they need.
Well, in the Kansas City metro region, if I if I have my geography and history correct, you guys have an op tempo where that's obviously required.
Yeah, it gets a little feisty around here at times, and especially, you know, in some of the smaller surrounding communities in the metropolitan area. They just don't have the staffing or the manpower to be able to do some of the things. So, like I said, just depending on, you know, everybody's kind of across the board moved away from no-knocks and things like that. But there's a lot of collaboration between everyone so that we're all on the same page.
Well, and even taking away the no-knock warrant stuff, I mean, there's a high likelihood of an increase in barricaded subjects that you're going to, like today with the DC. Gentleman's in a vehicle. He's claiming to have explosives and threatening to blow stuff up. That's essentially a barricaded subject. He just happens to be barricaded in a vehicle. So have you noticed an uptick of that type of SWAT call out?
Yeah, I think, you know, just in a general, you know, scenes, you know, from the beginning of COVID, you know, people were scared, people were hostile just because of the things going on. And as time went on, people started becoming agitated that their, you know, perceived that their rights were being taken away because they couldn't go out or things were closed. And so the mental health community was struggling, and therefore, we did see quite an uptick in, you know, situations where we felt like we needed to stage or, you know, domestic abuse, domestic violence was kind of on the uptick. And so, yeah, we did have quite a bit of awareness of what was going on. But, you know, luckily there wasn't anything that that resulted in us having to, you know, go to those lengths. It was more just being aware of it and knowing that it was out there and being prepared.
Sure. And with the tactically from a law enforcement perspective, once you do that, you remove that no knock, you're creating a greater opportunity for an individual to have a tactical advantage when it comes to realizing that law enforcement is looking for them and wanting to come after them, and now you can start to have a situation that gets dynamic very quickly without your ability to do a surprise, snatch and grab type thing. So I think that that's probably going to also increase just because of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think, you know, and we play different sides of the card, you know, when we're talking about different things. And when I talked earlier about the collaboration and the complement, when we go between law enforcement and EMS, there are teams where their medics are law enforcement. They're law enforcement officers. They are paramedics because they went to paramedic school, or they used to be in EMS and now they're in law enforcement. And then there's other teams like ours where we're strictly fire and EMS. And so, you know, for us, looking at those situations where the element of surprise is gone, or it's taken away, rather, that does pose a concern for us, because now, you know, you guys, and I say you guys, law enforcement has the ability to fire back, and we don't. And so those are things that we need to be more cognizant of and more aware of on the law enforcement side as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. So switching gears a little bit, you also founded Valor Fire Training, right?
Correct. Yeah, we started back in 2015, and we've been running strong ever since.
So what is Valor Training? Valor Fire Training.
So Valor Fire Training started out as a group of instructors that we all kind of worked together. We always enjoyed going and teaching. And then after a while, it became pretty apparent that, you know, running kind of out there just teaching, we needed to have a little bit more organization. So a couple of the instructors that I've worked with over the years, we all sat down and came up with the name Valor Fire Training. So We're located in the Midwest. We have instructors all over the area. So, you know, we have instructors up in Wisconsin, Michigan, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Kansas. And we come together and go teach classes. And if we do lectures, it's, you know, subject matter experts. So it's been a fun ride. We have always had a emphasis on realism in training, and that's kind of the pinnacle that we've always stood on. And it's worked out really well for us. You know, when people were talking about the safety culture in training, we made sure that we were finding a way to be safe, but still keeping it realistic. So we pride ourselves on having realistic fire conditions, role players. When we do, when it's applicable, when we can, we have live victims. And so they're, you know, fighting back with you, or they're moulaged up so that they're burn victims and you have to actually take care of them. So it's been a great ride. It's been fun. We're excited to see what's coming up next. We're going to start live streaming some shows. We also do YouTube shows with equipment reviews and interviews. And then the coolest thing that you got to be a part of, kind of, is we do a thing called the hot seat. So it's a hot wing challenge. We interview influential firefighters and instructors from across the country while they eat progressively hotter and hotter hot wings.
You did that at FDIC, didn't you? Show or have a video podcast of guys doing that?
I did. Yeah, it was Jason from Fire Department Chronicles and Brent from Firefighter Fenton, and it was a great time. It was really fun. It's, you know, I don't like doing it. I'm not a spicy lover, but I think that, you know, it adds kind of comedic humor while being educational. And so, I mean, there's times where I've done it 2 or 3 days in a row just to get the takes that we need with different instructors and different guests. So I'll keep doing it as long as people are enjoying it and they're learning something.
Well, I can tell you now, I'd last for about 30 seconds. So I'm not a hot wing spicy guy. There's just not my thing. I don't think I could survive that one. But dude, that's awesome. So basically the takeaway from all that is you don't sleep. You're ridiculously busy. Working your butt off, training and having your fingers in about 16 different pies.
Yeah. If you ask my wife, she'll tell you the same thing. I have two boys and a dog, and my wife is still happily married to me. I'm not really sure how, but, you know, I told her when we got married, you know, she understood the fire service and how things worked. And as soon as I got into the education realm and the teaching realm, what I told her was I want to leave the fire service better than I found it. You know, I want to leave it better than when I got in. And this is kind of my way of giving back. You know, when I leave the fire service, hopefully for retirement, I want to be knowledgeless. You know, I want to have all the knowledge that I've gained over the years passed on somewhere, somehow, to help the future generation. So if I can pull that off, it's mission accomplished.
I think that's ridiculously noble. And it's great that that's your drive to doing it in the first place. You know, there's lots of folks out there that look at it as a side hustle, a way to make money, a way to supplement some income. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's extra special when somebody's doing it because they want to leave an imprint. They want to share knowledge. They want to increase people's knowledge, skills, and abilities. So I applaud you for that. That's awesome.
Well, I appreciate that, man. You know, it's kind of funny when you said side hustle. It made me laugh. I've had that discussion with friends of mine who are business owners outside of the fire service, and they're constantly asking me, like, hey, man, why don't you do this? You'd make more money, or why don't you do that? You'd have more free time. And I said, you know, if I want a side hustle, I'll you know, be a painter, or I'll go start detailing cars or do something like that. But it's never really, you know, I mean, the only thing that's really interested me is the public safety side and teaching.
I have the exact same I had the exact same drive and same idea. So I think it's awesome, dude. Seriously. So with Valor Fire Training and your experience as a TAC medic, what are your thoughts on violent scene response? And I'll try to box it in because that's pretty broad scope. Day-to-day single unit type response stuff, where do you see we are as a service? Where do you think we need to be looking to go? And is your company trying to do anything to get there?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a great question, and the answer is probably not going to be super popular, but that's okay. You know, people will take it as they will. You know, where we are now, to me, is not where I think we need to be. It's not where I wanted to be, and it's not where I think we need to be. You know, when we look at situations from domestic battery or domestic violence that turns into, you know, aggravated assaults and things like that, those are the day-to-day type of things. But, you know, when we look at Columbine, the Pulse nightclub, the Las Vegas shooting, even things like today, there are specific units or specific groups of people within organizations that are on the right page and they're on the right plan, and they've had the right training. But I feel like we've always kind of put that on the back burner. You know, active shooter is a punchline. It's more of a, you know, buzzword where, oh, we're going to do active shooter training, and we go to a class for 30 minutes or an hour, and maybe we have a one scenario a year. And it's just like everything else. It's extremely high risk, low frequency. And so where we should be, because these things are happening so quickly, and they're happening more and more often. And I think that's the scary thing to me, is that 10 or 15 years ago, we didn't necessarily have the types of violence that we have now, and it didn't happen so quickly. And so, yeah, you had your situations that did, but they were kind of few and far between. Here in the metropolitan area, we've seen a huge uptick in violence, and, you know, crews are just responding to it the best that they know how. You know, they stage, or once they get in there, they just deal with patients on a case-by-case basis. But we're really, you know, nationally, when I look at how everyone's operating, there are very few organizations that have a firm, hard plan in the region or locally or, you know, things like that.
Well, yeah, for sure. I think part of the other thing to that, and it's an issue of the scream for collaboration and coordination for a decade or so. We're really quick to call something an active shooter. Where 5 years ago, hey, we got a drive-by shooting. We got, you know, two or three victims down, that kind of thing. Now it's an active shooter. We're doing a joint response. We got, you know, staging set up. We got forward teams operating. We have a unified command post. It's a huge thing. The media blows it all up. I think that is a just kind of a result of our call for that. And that has its pluses and its minuses for sure. But I think we're starting to define and quantify things into a box a little bit differently than we've done, you know, in the years past. So that's a good thing. And then, of course, as you said, you know, if you're not doing it the way you ought to do it, then it ain't such a good thing.
Absolutely.
But I have a caller that is holding in the queue. Let's bring this person on here real quick. Hi, you're on Scenes of Violence with Steve Hamilton and guest Dave Mellon.
Hey, Steve, how are you? It's Alex Rivera.
Oh, well, hello, Chief. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very good. David and the rest of the listeners, this is This is Alex Rivera. Alex is the fire chief for the fire department at the West Point Military Academy installation.
How are you doing, Mr. Mellon? And good to be here, Steve. Just calling in, listening into the interesting conversation. It's interesting that you're having this today. As I was just having this discussion with some of my colleagues and superiors, and trying to figure this out at our level as well. So I'm very happy to be listening in, and looking forward to hearing what you guys have to say. And I have a question pertaining to standards or a certification to a particular training standard or operational standard. Is this something that you guys see as an issue? Are there competing standards or competing ways of doing business in this area? And if so, are they vastly different, or are they pretty similar?
I think you picked the right night to call in. David, what are your thoughts on being having a training company, and obviously program development, execution, that kind of thing, weighs heavily in the standard realm. I mean, people who go to training, they want to be based on something that is measurable and researchable later. What are your thoughts on the chief's question?
Yeah, so I it's a great question, and Chief, thanks for calling in. It's nice to be able to talk with you. And, you know, I think the biggest thing is it's a twofold question. So let me start with the fire EMS side first. What we do is not law enforcement. You know, what we're responsible for in our response is not, and probably will never be, law enforcement, unless you're in some sort of public safety type organization where the police officers are firefighters and vice versa. But when we talk about our standards and what we're looking at, and to go back to Steve's question as well, you know, NFPA 3000 has been out for quite some time, and I know a lot of people who have never even attempted to look at it. And so, you know, that deals with active shooters and hostile events. And it kind of gives you a framework to be able to work within that. So, you know, what we've relied on a lot when we do our classes or anything pertaining to that at the organizational level is we revert back to TCCC, TECC, Stop the Bleed. Those are all programs that, you know, for the basic first responders, you know, office staff or, you know, somebody that may be pressed into service, they're going to have Stop the Bleed. For our paramedics and EMTs, they're going to have a TECC. So those are all standards that I think are really important. And when I said earlier that I feel like we're not where we should be, there are departments that will stress that every single provider has to have a CPR card, an ACLS card, PHTLS, PALS, NIMS, but they don't require them to have TECC or Stop the Bleed or any of the other type of training, because I think we just kind of take it for granted. On the company side of things, that's where it gets really difficult, because, you know, we have a lot more freedom to teach the things that work. But we have to base them off of solid evidence-based medicine or solid evidence-based tactics. And so we rely heavily on our law enforcement and our military, you know, cadre members who have that knowledge and have those resources, and can actually go out there and put that information out and cite where they got it from, cite the studies or cite the standards from a law enforcement side as well. So does that kind of answer the question?
Yeah, it does. It does answer the question. And I think it leads into another question I had specifically with frequency of training. You mentioned earlier that this is one of those low frequency, high risk events. And we have several of those types of events like this that can fall into our scope of services dependent on our organization's capabilities. So my question is in terms of exercising these capabilities, you know, from a crawl, walk, run plan of attack or perspective,
What is your opinion on how to really start establishing that and making this a, I guess you could say, a more frequent or a more, I guess, more of a training or more of a focus on this particular type of incident? Again, I know on our end we exercise it, but we don't exercise it regularly. But when we do, it's kind of a big event. And then it's left at that. And so do you have any ways that you've incorporated that into your organization or any ideas you've seen from others?
Yeah. So, you know, that's a great question. And I don't mean to pick on you, but I'm going to do just a little bit. You know, I've been involved with some military installations and some government facilities with an EMS organization. And, you know, it always kind of cracks me up when they have those full-scale exercises. It's the terrorist attack with the chlorine storage that has a nuclear device that ends up with, you know, a bus full of children. And it's like the absolute worst case scenario that you could ever imagine. But they want to get the biggest bang for their buck. And so they're trying to hit multidisciplinary things. And I get that. But the way that I've always broken it down on with my crews and my cadre when we teach is, we're going to break it down just like we do on the fireside. So if I go on a medical call for a person who fell and it's just a lift assistance, while we're in there, every once in a while, you know, sometimes we talk about fire stuff, sometimes we talk about hazmat. Every once in a while I'll say, okay, we're getting this person up off the floor and all of a sudden they reach underneath the couch and grab a gun. What would we have done? And it starts that conversation of, yeah, okay, well, this person would have jumped on top of them. I would have grabbed their legs. You know, how would we have managed trying to keep them from doing what they were doing? Who would have gotten on the radio to call for help? And because these situations happen so quickly, I mean, look at Chicago, you know, where the two officers were shot, or three total, but two critical. You know, that happened in an instant. And so how are we going to react? So even the other day, we were doing a pre-plan on a school that's being built in our district, and one of the things that we talked about was, okay, where do we have hard barriers? Where can we seek, shielding if we need to, if there was an active shooter inside of this building? While the law enforcement is rushing in, we still need to mobilize. So how are we going to do that and do that safely? So it can be as easy as a conversation, but then something as simple also as, you know, every once in a while, walk into your kitchen with your crews and just throw a couple tourniquets on the table and say, hey, put these on, and just see how long it takes. You know, that could be something that's easy to do, or take a wound packing trainer and walk in during rest time or whatever you guys have and say, hey, I want you guys to show me real quick how you do this. So it just gets that conversation started.
Yeah, that's all excellent advice. And I know you're right. I think sometimes we can have the tendency to maybe overcomplicate things or just not take that. We try to go full sprint from the beginning instead of, you know, again, taking our time, identifying what our purpose is in the first place, what we're trying to get out of this whole thing. And then sometimes we tend to overcomplicate that. So, you know, I can definitely agree on your perspective or your description of, you know, what you've seen in some places. I definitely agree with that 100%. Now, the NFPA piece of the NFPA 3000, you mentioned a little while ago that it really, and Steve, it really sounds like I'm actually asking the interview questions, and by no means am I trying to. I apologize.
That's okay.
Oh, no, you
it.
Should.
I don't know if Steve is. But...
No, this is the point. When you have it, when we have a guest come on, it's I'm facilitating. All this stuff is that's the point. It's to reach out and ask the guest questions. I please lay it out.
No, it's interesting that you're actually having this conversation, because I was having a conversation with my boss earlier, and in particularly about the NFPA 3000 and what role it's currently playing. And I heard what you guys had said earlier that, hey, there's guys that, you know, this NFPA standard has been out for quite some time now, and some guys have either, A, haven't heard about it or never even looked at it. So from your perspective, you know, what type of guide or what type of information is it, you know, for someone like me who's making a decision on how we're going to deploy these things for our communities, what type of guide or guidance is it providing? What recommendation do you have, you know, in terms of start? Where do you start? I don't know how big the NFPA standard is, but if it's like most, it's probably quite a few pages. So what is, you know, again, just based on your experience, your education with it, what's a good starting point when looking at that? What's something
I
can take back to my
think...
Hey, dude, I just heard from this really smart guy who said, hey, based on his experience and expertise in this area, here's some things that we can do with this standard.
Yeah, and I don't know about really smart dude, but I'll try to answer the question the best I can. But, yeah, so I think that, you know, when you talk about the NFPA 3000 standard, it was built out of necessity, right? It was formulated and developed out of necessity because we saw the need as an organization, as the fire service, we knew that we needed something. So it really does give good framework, and it really does talk about, you know, the best practices. But I am very vocal in the fact that there are certain things about the NFPA standards that I'm not a fan of. They're extremely difficult to get a hold of. You know, you can buy them, you can purchase them, you can do the subscription. But me as the lay rescuer, if I want to go in and take a look at an NFPA standard, I can't. I have to find somebody who has it, or I have to find someone who has the account. And so it is doable, but like you said, if it's, you know, 1,000 pages or 500 pages, it gets a little tedious. So really what I've found, the NFPA standard is great to pull best practices and kind of get a general idea, just like we do with training, just like we do with high-rise fire tactics, just as we do with, you know, a lot of different things, you know, apparatus maintenance and SCBA specs and all those things. But the biggest thing that you have to start with is building the relationship with law enforcement. If you're not going to build a relationship with law enforcement from the top down, so you're a chief, you need to be on the same page as the chief. The captains need to be on the same page as the bosses at the street level with the law enforcement. My position in my career department is a back-end firefighter. But on the volunteer side, I'm basically what's the equivalent of like a battalion chief of EMS. So I'm going to be functioning at two different levels depending on where I'm at if there's an act of violence. So years ago, and I say like 10, 15, 20 years ago, if there was any act of violence, the fire department was where? Where did we find the fire and EMS agencies?
So an act, we probably in a staging area, I would assume.
Yeah, like 2 miles away.
Yeah, they staged like, you know, 20 miles away, you know, not 20 miles, but they staged, you know, way away. And they would wait for the situation to be resolved. Well, now what we're seeing is because of evidence-based medicine, because of trauma casualty care overseas, we know, and it's a proven fact, that the faster we can get care to those people, the better. So now we're starting to see that integration. But imagine taking some of your crew members and saying, hey, you're going to go in with an armed task force, and they're going to take in the rescue task force to go start taking care of patients. Oh, but you've never met these guys. You've never trained with these guys and gals. You don't know anything about law enforcement. They're carrying guns. It's just you can make it work, but it has to start with building those relationships and then doing integrated training. You know, one of the most eye-opening experiences that I went through was going through a tactical medic program where we were exposed to everything from, you know, trying to provide patient care while there's flashbangs going off or SIM rounds or, you know, things like that that made it really, really difficult. But even being tased or being pepper sprayed, if you're not familiar with that and it happens during an actual incident, you don't want that to be the first time. So as far as the things to be able to take back, I think the biggest thing is sitting down with law enforcement and finding out, okay, here's where we want to be because of this NFPA standard. We want to be able to go into the warm zone. We want to be able to go in and start triaging, doing immediate life-saving measures so that we can stop bleeding, do a quick airway, whatever we need to do to save these people's lives, but do it safely and do it within an area that you feel comfortable with. And I think you'll gain a lot more traction that way Because what I found in the past is when we talk about doing all this great stuff on the fire side, once we get to that law enforcement table, they don't want to have anything to do with it. There's a huge reluctancy until we've started working collaboratively and working together and training together, and then that opens up all those doors.
Well, and I'll add to that, if I might. First, I'll let the cat out of the bag. I'm on the standards committee for NFPA 3000. So the standards actually, it really isn't that big, to be honest with you. The body of the standard, you know, taking out the annex and explanatory material, is only about 30 pages. But in response to some of the chief's inquiries and I guess trying to figure out your footing, the competency chapters within the document, chapter 12 is law enforcement competencies and 13 is fire. The competencies for law enforcement are three. And when NFPA says competencies, they're talking about knowledge of. So you could have that 30-minute class, and as long as you have knowledge of whatever that competency is, you gain it in that class. Okay, cool. You've met the competencies for that. So competencies aren't JPRs. But law enforcement has three competencies in general for ASHRAE events, and that's knowledge of the unified command structure, knowledge of tasks, you know, required for their agency, what's allowed by statute in their jurisdiction, et cetera, and then the competencies associated with their job. So, you know, rules of engagement, use of force, things like that. When you go to the fire chapter for competencies, it's a little bit bigger. Our list of competencies in general stands to like 22 in number. And then it breaks it down further into, you know, vehicle as a weapon, which is an additional five, IEDs is an additional four, that kind of thing. And it's simplistic in the way that it's structured. However, I think to the starting point for anybody outside of what Dave said with having that relationship, that handshake and smile between agencies is critical. That's a huge theme of this show. We talk about it a lot. If you don't have that relationship, you're done before you even start. You should be on a first name basis with your equal rank or equal position within your brother sister agencies. If you're not, you got to get out there and start liaising and interacting and networking, or as we said, you're done before you start. Having said that, is go to those competencies. Go to those competencies and look at what is being recommended that your personnel need to have knowledge of. So, as an example, for a competency for fire, a competency is having knowledge of patient distribution plans and procedures, for example. Grab a firefighter. Hey, if we had a mass cal right now, what do we do as far as determining patient status, what hospital they go to, how they're going to get there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's essentially what it's asking you, or directing you to do is to do that. Or as Dave said already, you know, TECC, NFPA doesn't want to attach to a name that could be considered a trademark or a copyright or something like that. And there's some back and forth as to whether TEC is that. So they box it into procedures for threat-based care. So you have to have knowledge of threat-based care because there's more than just the TECC. So for the military, the active duty members, they do TCCC. That's not good for fire and EMS in the civilian sector. It's not even good for fire and EMS on the military installations. People don't necessarily understand that our military installation population is the same as that out in a city, unless you're in a war zone. We have retirees, we have geriatric population, a pediatric population, we have special needs populations, we have the spectrum of any other jurisdiction. So TCCC is kind of fenced to adults between the ages of 18 and 45 with an expected expected health status being pretty healthy already. So TECC kind of dives into it a little differently. Outside of some of the competing standards, at 3,000 is kind of the only national standard that I am aware of that addresses all the disciplines, being law enforcement, fire, EMS, that kind of thing. And because of that, I think that that's kind of a go-to. There's been a big market push, but I agree with the both of you. There's lots of people who are unaware that NFPA 3000 is shelved and is out there. I think that that's your go-to guide. Get a copy of it, read it. If you can't get a copy of it, you're not buying it. There is a free access to it on NFPA.org. When you scroll down to view this document, you can click free access. You don't have to pay for it. However, that also means you can't print it. You can't screenshot it. So you literally have to read it on the screen. And that's pretty much the only way you're going to be able to look at it.
Hey, Steve. Yeah, that answered, I think, the both of you guys in combination definitely answered my questions. Great information. Hey, Steve, I've actually I've been going back and forth with my boss. He's actually called in as well, and I don't know if he has any questions, but he's got a law enforcement background, so he might be able to bring some different perspective to the conversation. I don't know if you see him on hold or anything.
I do. I was gonna bring that on right now. Stand by.
All right.
Hey,
hello, welcome to Scenes of Violence. This is Steve Hamilton. You're on the line with David Mellon and Chief Alex Rivera from West Point Fire.
Hey, good evening, sir. How you doing?
Very good, sir. How are you?
Great. I just joined in a few minutes ago. Alex texted me and said, hey, this is really great information. And I guess I tuned in about the time that you were talking about some of the military installation, and I think one of the things that stood out to me, and there's a lot that came to mind, but the number one, the biggest adjustment, I came here as a lieutenant colonel. I came to West Point as a lieutenant colonel, as a director, and a host of tours to Afghanistan, Iraq. And in the military background, NTC, JRTC, and the one thing that I had no idea about was NIMS. Just the structure, the talk, so forth and so on. So that was a big jump for me to dive into. And to be honest with you, without the fire chief at the time to really help me along with that, it had probably been a lot harder than what it needed to be. So having, as you were talking about the relationships, not just as you were talking about externally with my, police brothers and sisters, whether it's federal or state, even the local police, really internally with the fire guys, that helped me immensely. That was step one for me as a green suitor. Then expanding out with the state police, the Orange County SWORT, the sheriff's department, so forth and so on. We really utilize those relationships, as you were talking about, to expand on our capabilities. That grew into sharing TTPs, how we would handle situations. And what I got to before I retired, it was basically, we call it the go-to-war plan, for active shooter. And it was from alert of a possible active shooter, notifications, procedures, that we are taking from both an LE perspective and a fire perspective. For me, that was key. When we would do our full scale exercises, we would pull that out. It wasn't an end all be all, but it was just, here are the major steps you have to do. And that helped, you know, as the situation, you know, unfolded and you're trying to figure that out as the incident commander, it was very helpful to have that list, you know, in my battle book there, the incident command post, like, okay, have I done these things? Boom, 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 got them. So between, at the time, Jamie Rohner, when the assistant chiefs, you know, putting together the fire department side, you know, I felt like we were pretty squared away. Internally, we had that battle book. Externally, we had discussed TTPs. We knew where the staging area was going to be, all the local police, state police, county elements. They all knew where to go. So we were tied tight, and it was exactly what you were talking about. Pretty much everything you said was spot on. In the limited amount I got to listen to, you know, I really felt – that what you were saying was spot on the relationship piece and tying in the part that we, I think from a federal perspective, are really trying to get our hands around and figure out how it would work is the rescue task force piece. You know, I think we have a pretty solid idea. But it seems to be ever evolving, and unlike NIMS, which we all rely on, you know, whatever organization you're coming from, NIMS serves as that common operating picture for all of us to utilize. Active shooter doesn't seem quite there yet. You know, Orange County, where we're at, you know, they've taken kind of the lead on trying to organize our, hey, look, this is how we're going to do it within the county. So we're all on the same page. I know, you know, Army-wise, you know, they're trying to put the same thing together, but that's probably where we're not as tight as we are in other areas, if that makes sense.
It does. And I know Dave has written articles and has done classes on cultural issues within, like, the fire service. So the perfect storm, kind of like a brewing storm of red flags associated with behavioral things, stuff like that you're seeing in the fire service. Mm-hmm. But I think, and Dave, you stop me if I'm wrong, I think that's concept kind of encompasses where we are culturally in emergency services and trying to address that active shooter situation where, you know, I know you've talked about, you know, well, we've always done it this way. We've always staged, well, the cops do their thing. We do our thing. That kind of fits in line with that ideology that you go after. Seems kind of worthy that maybe West Point could benefit from maybe checking that out or possibly getting with you about some more information. Is that something you offer through your teachings available to others?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we do kind of a shameless plug, but yeah, we do, it's a class that is called The Perfect Storm, Preventing Operational Catastrophe. And it really kind of focuses in on not just fire service. I mean, it can be all inclusive. So, I mean, I've actually done it for corporations and tailored it to them. But yeah, when you talk about, you know, especially during COVID and with a lot of the shutdowns, you had a lot of businesses that were shutting down. You had a lot of people that were getting laid off. You had a lot of disgruntled coworkers. And so, you know, especially with mental health and where it is right now, whether it's on a military installation or not, you have probably already had this year multiple red flags, multiple times where people who are gun owners or do have access to things that could cause a lot of destruction, they were upset about something. They just haven't reached that point. And so, you know, yeah, there is a aspect of our cultures between law enforcement and fire and EMS that when we talk about how we're going to respond to those things, we already know what works and what doesn't work. We already know the evidence. We already have the statistics. It's just getting past that point of this is my sandbox, don't play in it. And I think we're getting there, but you asked the question earlier, you know, where do I think we need to be and where would I like to see us in the future? I would like to see us completely integrated together, working side by side. And I don't mean that in the tactical sense. You know, I don't mean me standing right next to the boss, you know, the hallway boss, as we're going down a hallway with a rifle. I mean that we already know that when we show up on scene of a hostile event, depending on what type of event it is, those things are already set up. The police chief had mentioned law enforcement staging. They already know where they're going to be staging for, you know, a dozen or so agencies. But does fire get included in that? Do we know where the fire units are going to be staging? Are we all on the same radio channel? Now, I was just having a discussion with somebody last week that all of the law enforcement channels in their area are completely encrypted, and law enforcement doesn't have fire channels, and fire department doesn't have law enforcement channels. So now they're forced to go onto their radios, which are 800 digital, and they have to go to scan like five different zones over to be able to get to a regional channel that everybody can talk on. But then you lose your ability to have tactical conversations. So those are still going to have to be on the old channel. So it's just a lot of those things that I really thought in 2021 we would have had a better handle on, if that makes sense.
I mean, I think it does. And the reason that I put that out there is because I think that those concepts, and not necessarily that anybody has to get a class out of it, you've written several articles on the subject. It establishes the why. And I think when you're seeking a training solution to an operational issue or risk, the biggest thing that you're gonna struggle with is helping people to understand what the why is, and that you're doing it for a very good reason. If you lose the why, then you lose the attention span and applicability of the information you're trying to push out there and people's ability to absorb it. So I think that's an excellent concept to go off of first. As far as the incident command issue that Mr. Allison was bringing up, presidential directive, NIMS, everybody's got to have it, 100, 200, 700, 800, did that. Then we did the 3 and the 4, okay. We've checked those boxes, but I think the operators, firefighters, company officers, patrol officers, corporals, even all the way up to sergeants, that relationship is there. We can have cheeseburgers at the station or beers at the bar, and we're good with that. I think once you go above that and you start to get into the senior leadership ranks, that relationship may not be to that level. You may interact on a regular basis. You may interact even on the daily, but is your relationship such that it is where you can go grab a beer, you have a stake in the game with each other? When we're operating and I'm looking at the firefighter next to me, or I'm looking at the cop next to me on an emergency scene, there's that understanding that we're relying on each other for safety and for, you know, termination of the event without it getting worse. The senior leaders who are not in a command post necessarily, who are back trying to deal with plan and recovery in the next 15 minutes and trying to stand up an incident operations center or emergency operations center, they may not have that relationship. So their only opportunity to kind of stress those things is, as we already articulated, the exercise that you do every year. And, you know, once the military starts to plan an exercise and everybody finds out about it, everybody being the different units and things like that, everybody tries to tack on to that one exercise, one, because it's fiscally responsible, and two, you don't have to start and pre-plan one for yourself. That's how that exercise turns into, you know, anthrax, you know, in the water supply and VX gas being dropped from a crop duster and swimming ducks with Uzis in the pond and, you know, 5,000 casualties and all of them are alive and you got to transport all of them. The downtown hospitals have to have a certain amount of patients.
It's so true.
You know, it is that. So the thing is or you have to do a needs assessment and figure out where are we at, where do we need to grow to, and how do we go about getting there? And you really, in my opinion, you need to tackle one of three modalities. And you can tackle them simultaneously, or you can evaluate it yourself. You got to look at tasks, tactics, and strategy, and you box in whatever you're trying to accomplish. For this, it's Asher. Where are we at with task level knowledge? You know, can our personnel do the medical piece as Dave was talking about under stress? You know, with some type of dynamic scenario. Tactically, how about the amount of resources that I need to get the amount of casualties that I have at a casualty collection point off the X? That, can that be strategic? Yeah, I guess you could probably say it might be, but that's their box, so that's a tactic. And then strategically, for a military installation, we have a major event. What are we going to do? We're going to lock down the installation. Once we lock the installation down, how are we getting assets on and off the installation? If need be, you might not need to, but if you need to, and then further, once you slam those gates shut, what's going to happen to the traffic outside of your installation? Probably going to back up for several miles because anybody with a loved one at the installation is going to do what when they hear on the news that there's an event there. You know, they're going to come to the installation.
Real quick. If I can interject, this is an amazing conversation. I'm already, sitting here taking notes. I've gotten a lot out of it. I have little kids, so I'm going to have to pop off here in a second and go help out. You caught me in bath / get to bedtime. But, what you were just talking about, so on the mill side, you know, for instance, if I'm in Afghanistan and I'm running a TAC, we're constantly monitoring and, we're waiting for something to happen as our missions, go forth. But one of the things, as you were talking about assets, I think in my time here at West Point and doing full scale exercises, whether, we did a rock and oil, spill, for the fire department the first year I was here, and I think ever since then it's been some sort of active shooter exercise. However, the one gap I think we have as far as planning and being organized and so on is what assets are available to me on a daily basis. There's a lot out there, but I think if there was a system where you can punch into, and it probably already exists, I just don't know about it, but to know what's available to me on a Monday to handle said event, whether, it is an active shooter or it's, some natural disaster or what have you, from a county, state, level aperture. I think that would really help whoever is, running the show as an incident commander. And leveraging what's out there. A lot of times on our end, from a NIMS and this sort of operation, it's you got to call the EOC. The EOC track down. Hey, what do we have? And you're waiting for a little bit to get that information, but if there's a way to streamline that and know, what is out there, I think that would help out and speed things up a little bit. But like I was saying, I have to get off of this. Unfortunately, I have to go help. But I was texting back and forth with Alex as you're talking, and I was like, hey, look, we need to facilitate this and get conversation going. I know my director, he would, he's going to want to, jump into this and talk as well. So, if we can get something scheduled where we can continue to talk about this, I think it's a great conversation. I think anytime you know, we can, you know, talk about these things and share notes, as you were saying, it definitely helps. The last thing, and, you know, I've never thought about it until you said about sitting down and having beers together, and I'm just like, man, I can't believe I never thought about this. But, like, you know, Mike, the great organizations that I've been in the military all had that common theme of we were very tight together, you know. We went and did things together. You know, there was that esprit de corps that we had with each other. And you hit it on the head there. Like, it does – people undervalue that. I mean, that is a huge thing. It makes a big difference when things like this happen and everybody's stressed. And, you know, the real you comes out. Like, those relationships and the time that you spend together, it makes a massive difference. It really does. And like I was saying, I mean, the best units that I've been in, they had that. And then you see a difference when they don't. So I think, you know, a lot of what you said tonight, the little time that I was listening to you, I mean, from my experience, you know, for what that's worth, I mean, it was all solid and right on the money. So I'd love to, you know, what I told Alice is get something on the calendar and sit down and continue the conversation. I appreciate you letting me jump into it.
Oh, absolutely. And Chief Rivera's got my contact information, and we can link up, and I'll share Dave Mellon's contact information, and I think we'll help fill some of your gaps, especially Dave. We'll help fill some of your stuff to the points that you were mentioning. So thank you for calling out.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
Real quick, Chief, before you go, I just want to let you know that, you know, I worked for an organization that worked really closely with Fort Leavenworth up in Leavenworth, Kansas.
Okay.
And
yep.
We would do the, you know, every year the plane crash into the school and the, you know, ammonia leak and all that good stuff. But the one thing that came out of that is that we did work very closely, and they would come off base, you know, they'd come off the fort to assist us. We would come on the fort to assist them. And so there were a lot of times where, you know, I'm standing next to a captain from the fort, and they function completely different than we do. But it was all first name basis. It was all, you know, hey, we're going to go ahead and do this. What do you need from us? You know, and it worked so well. And so, you know, now we're the organizations that I'm with are a little bit further away, so we don't really, I mean, unless something really bad happens. But yeah, that was my first taste of the government side of things, where, you know, they really did have that cooperative, collaborative effort, and it was awesome. So, yeah, anything that I can do to help you out, I'd be happy to.
Yeah, no, that'd be great, Dave. I think that'd be and, you know, like I was saying, Steve, anytime you could sit down and share notes. I was at Fort Hood when the Fort Hood shooting happened, and I knew the you know, director of emergency services. He actually came to West Point, did a pretty big leadership professional development session there. We got a lot into the mitigation side, you know, after the kinetic piece is over. But, you know, you just, you know, you never know who you're going to be able to share some information with that, you know, can help out down the road. Ultimately, look, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, whatever everybody brings to the table collectively, you know, if we save one life, then it was well worth it. So I think that's how we all look at it and improve the foxhole, and then we just keep getting after it. And these conversations are, you know, immensely important in getting there.
Hey,
well, again, thanks
Dave,
for
– this is Alex. Yeah.
Hey, just wanted to thank you guys. Hey, I got to get going as well. Thank you for taking my questions, answering my questions. Fantastic work, guys. Fantastic things you guys are doing. Appreciate you guys and look forward to working with you guys in the future.
Thanks. I appreciate you calling in.
All right, brother.
Yeah, have a great night, guys.
Thank you, sir. So, we're about at that a little bit over that 1 hour witching hour, where I kind of start to box things in a little bit. Dave, I'm going to give you an opportunity to kind of throw the last word out there. I don't want to monopolize your time all night. do you have any closing stuff you want to throw out there? And the floor is yours, brother, in whatever manner you would like to put it out there.
Well, I appreciate it, man. And you know, I have really enjoyed, you know, I just sit back and kind of listen and, you know, the discussions that we've had just tonight, in the small time that we've had have been awesome. But, you know, the one thing that I kind of want to leave everybody with who's listening is, you know, the understanding that when we talk about active violence, when we talk about active shooters and things like that, it takes all shapes and forms. And so I think a lot of times we take it for granted. You know, it's easy to spot, and as you said before, they're so quick to call anything an active shooter. But it's easy to spot the person with a long rifle going into a movie theater. It's easy to spot the person in a school who's using improvised explosive devices. But when we talk about the global sense of, you know, someone who is upset with the government or us, and it could be something as simple as going in for a well check. And as you're talking to the patient from a first responder standpoint, they're digging into a couch. One thing that I want to kind of relay to everybody, and this actually happened to a good friend of mine. He was dealing with a patient who was agitated and upset. The patient kept putting his hand in the couch. And when they went back and looked at the body camera footage from the law enforcement officers, they recognized what was going on after the fact. Yeah, that's real bad.
Yeah,
right?
That's
real bad.
That's not good.
No. And, you know, he was an elderly male. He was agitated. He was saying things that were inflammatory. He was using foul language. There was a lot of body language and behavior that, you know, the thing that kind of got my attention when I watched the video was that at one point he reached over and he grabbed a TV remote and he pointed it at everyone like he was holding a gun. And so, you know, what they found out later, after he had become so aggressive that they had to use force to get him on the ground and get him restrained and take him out to the ambulance, is that he had a loaded .38 revolver underneath the couch. He was just sitting on the wrong side. And so these things can take a lot of different shapes and can happen in a lot of different ways. And so being prepared for the end of the world, as we found out in 2020, being prepared for an active shooter or a large-scale incident is just as important as being ready for the crew-level incident, the things that happen on a medical that you're not expecting. So take time to learn those things. Take time to talk to your crews and talk to your people in your organization and find out, hey, if this happens, how are we going to do this? What are our steps? How can we get a hold of dispatch and tell them that we have an emergency if we can't just come out and say, we have an emergency? We have to do it discreetly. Those are all things that need to be discussed. And I'm hoping that if we have this discussion again sometime in the future, that a lot of these things have been kind of become commonplace. I would love to see it not be the exception to the rule. And I think that there's a lot of great people like yourself and others that are out there trying to make it that way. So thank you for having me on. I appreciate it, man. If there's ever anything that I can do for anyone, please feel free to shoot me a message on Facebook or, you know, via email, and I'll try and do what I can.
Well, and thank you for coming on. I know you're a busy guy, but I think we got to kind of like a shameless plug. But trust, there's nothing scripted whenever I do this, and that just. That just played out naturally, and it's an honest thing. You got some really great concepts. You present some really heads-up ways to dealing with challenges that departments face, both administratively, culturally, operationally. I think it's awesome, and I applaud your reasonings behind doing it. because it's for the right reasons and it's being done the right way. So thank you for what you do. And it would be great to have you back on the show. We'll do this again. Maybe we'll structure it, set it up a little bit, have a couple extra guests, but I'd love to chew your brain a little bit more with an audience and see what pops out on the other end.
Absolutely, man. Anytime.
And for anybody who's got my stuff and wants to connect with David Mellon, reach out, let me know, and I'll put you guys together and we'll see if good heads can come up with greater plans. But other than that, thank you very much for tuning in. We're going to sign it off. Steve Hamilton, Scenes of Violence, greatly appreciate you taking time out of your Thursday to listen in. Stay safe out there. Keep your head on a swivel. And we'll see you next time.